Keating got up. He dragged his feet to a dresser, opened a drawer, took out a crumpled piece of paper and handed it to Toohey. It was his contract with Rourke. Toohey read it and chuckled once, a dry snap of sound. Then he looked at Keating.
You're a complete success, Peter, as far as I'm concerned. But at times I have to want to turn away from the sight of my successes.
Keating stood by the dresser, his shoulders slumped, his eyes empty.
I didn't expect you to have it in writing like that, with his signature.
So that's what he's done for you. And this is what you do in return. No, I take back the insults, Peter. You had to do it. Who are you to reverse the laws of history? Do you know what this paper is?
The impossible perfect. The dream of the centuries. The aim of all of mankind's great schools of thought. You harnessed him. You made him work for you. You took his achievement, his reward, his money, his glory, his name. We only thought and wrote about it. You gave a practical demonstration. Every philosopher from Plato up should thank you. Here it is, the philosopher's stone, for turning gold into lead.
I should be pleased. But I guess I'm human and I can't help it. I'm not pleased. I'm just sick. The others, Plato and all the rest, they really thought it would turn lead into gold. I knew the truth from the first. I've been honest with myself, Peter, and that's the hardest form of honesty. The one you all run from at any price. And right now I don't blame you. It is the hardest one, Peter. He sat down wearily and held the paper by the corners in both hands. He said,
If you want to know how hard it is, I'll tell you. Right now I want to burn this paper.
Make what you wish of that. I don't claim too great a credit, because I know that tomorrow I'll send this to the district attorney. Rourke will never know it, and it would make no difference to him if he knew. But in the truth of things, there was one moment when I wanted to burn this paper.
He folded the paper cautiously and slipped it into his pocket. Keating followed his gestures, moving his whole head, like a kitten watching a ball on a string.
You make me sick, said Toohey. God, how you make me sick! All you hypocritical sentimentalists, you go along with me, you spout what I teach you, you profit by it, but you haven't the grace to admit to yourself what you're doing. You turn green when you see the truth. I suppose that's in the nature of your natures, and that's precisely my chief weapon, but God, I get tired of it. I must allow myself a moment free of you. That's what I have to put on an act for all my life. For mean little mediocrities like you. To protect your sensibilities, your posturings, your conscience, and the peace of the mind you haven't got. That's the price I pay for what I want, but at least I know that I've got to pay it, and I have no illusions about the price or the purchase.
What do you want, Ellsworth?
Power, Petey. There were steps in the apartment above, someone skipping gaily. A few sounds on the ceiling, as of 4 or 5 tap beats. The light fixture jingled, and Keating's head moved up in obedience. Then it came back to Toohey. Toohey was smiling, almost indifferently.
You always said, Keating began thickly, and stopped.
I've always said just that. Clearly, precisely, and openly. It's not my fault if you couldn't hear. You could, of course. You didn't want to, which was safer than deafness. For me. I said I intended to rule, like all my spiritual predecessors. But I'm luckier than they were. I inherited the fruit of their efforts, and I shall be the one who'll see the great dream made real. I see it all around me today. I recognize it. I don't like it. I didn't expect to like it. Enjoyment is not my destiny. I shall find such satisfaction as my capacity permits. I shall rule.
Whom?
You. The world. It's only a matter of discovering the lever. If you learn how to rule one single man's soul, you can get the rest of mankind. It's the soul, Peter, the soul. Not whips, or swords, or fire, or guns. That's why the Caesars, the Attilas, the Napoleons were fools and did not last.
We will. The soul, Peter, is that which can't be ruled. It must be broken. Drive a wedge in, get your fingers on it, and the man is yours. You won't need a whip, he'll bring it to you and ask to be whipped. Set him in reverse, and his own mechanism will do your work for you. Use him against himself. Want to know how it's done? See if I ever lied to you. See if you haven't heard all this for years but didn't want to hear, and the fault is yours, not mine. There are many ways. Here's one. Make man feel small. Make him feel guilty. Kill his aspiration and his integrity. That's difficult. The worst among you gropes for an ideal in his own twisted way. Kill integrity by internal corruption. Use it against itself. Direct it toward a goal destructive of all integrity. Preach selflessness. Tell man that he must live for others. Tell men that altruism is the ideal. Not a single one of them has ever achieved it, and not a single one ever will. His every living instinct screams against it. But don't you see what you accomplish? Man realizes that he's incapable of what he's accepted as the noblest virtue, and it gives him a sense of guilt, of sin, of his own basic unworthiness. Since the supreme ideal is beyond his grasp, he gives up eventually all ideals, all aspiration, all sense of his personal value. He feels himself obliged to preach what he can't practice, but one can't be good halfway, or honest approximately. To preserve one's integrity is a hard battle. Why preserve that which one knows to be corrupt already? His soul gives up its self-respect. You've got him. He'll obey. He'll be glad to obey because he can't trust himself. He feels uncertain. He feels unclean. That's one way. Here's another. Kill man's sense of values. Kill his capacity to recognize greatness or to achieve it. Great men can't be ruled. We don't want any great men. Don't deny the conception of greatness. Destroy it from within. The great is the rare, the difficult, the exceptional. Set up standards of achievement open to all, to the least, to the most inept, and you stop the impetus to effort in all men, great or small. You stop all incentive to improvement, to excellence, to perfection. Laugh at Rourke and hold Peter Keating as a great architect. You've destroyed architecture. Build up Lois Cook, and you've destroyed literature. Hail Ike, and you've destroyed the theater. Glorify Lancelot Clokey, and you've destroyed the press. Don't set out to raise all shrines. You'll frighten men. Enshrine mediocrity, and the shrines are raised. Then there's another way. Kill by laughter. Laughter is an instrument of human joy. Learn to use it as a weapon of destruction. Turn it into a sneer. It's simple. Tell them to laugh at everything. Tell them that a sense of humor is an unlimited virtue. Don't let anything remain sacred in a man's soul, and his soul won't be sacred to him. Kill reverence, and you've killed the hero in man. One doesn't reverence with a giggle. He'll obey, and he'll set no limits to his obedience. Anything goes. Nothing is too serious. Here's another way. This is most important. Don't allow men to be happy. Happiness is self-contained and self-sufficient. Happy men have no time and no use for you. Happy men are free men. So, kill their joy in living. Take away from them whatever is dear or important to them. Never let them have what they want. Make them feel that the mere fact of a personal desire is evil. Bring them to a state where saying, I want, is no longer a natural right, but a shameful admission. Altruism is of great help in this. Unhappy men will come to you. They'll need you. They'll come for consolation, for support, for escape. Nature allows no vacuum. Empty man's soul, and the space is yours to fill. I don't see why you should look so shocked, Peter. This is the oldest one of all. Look back at history. Look at any great system of ethics from the Orient up. Didn't they all preach the sacrifice of personal joy? Under all the complications of verbiage, haven't they all had a single leitmotif? Sacrifice? Renunciation? Self-denial? Haven't you been able to catch their theme song? Give up, give up, give up, give up. Look at the moral atmosphere of today. Everything enjoyable, from cigarettes to sex to ambition to the profit motive, is considered depraved or sinful. Just prove that a thing makes men happy, and you've damned it. That's how far we've come. We've tied happiness to guilt. And we've got mankind by the throat. Throw your firstborn into a sacrificial furnace, lie on a bed of nails, go into the desert to mortify the flesh. Don't dance. Don't go to the movies on Sunday. Don't try to get rich. Don't smoke. Don't drink. It's all the same line, the great line. Fools think that taboos of this nature are just nonsense, something left over, old-fashioned. But there's always a purpose in nonsense. Don't bother to examine a folly. Ask yourself only what it accomplishes. Every system of ethics that preached sacrifice grew into a world power and ruled millions of men. Of course, you must dress it up. You must tell people that they'll achieve a superior kind of happiness by giving up everything that makes them happy. You don't have to be too clear about it. Use big, vague words. Universal harmony. Eternal spirit. Divine purpose. Nirvana. Paradise. Racial supremacy. The dictatorship of the proletariat. Internal corruption, Peter. That's the oldest one of all. The farce has been going on for centuries and men still fall for it. Yet the test should be so simple. Just listen to any prophet, and if you hear him speak of sacrifice, run. Run faster than from a plague. It stands to reason that where there's sacrifice, there's someone collecting sacrificial offerings. Where there's service, there's someone being served. The man who speaks to you of sacrifice speaks of slaves and masters, and intends to be the master. But if ever you hear a man telling you that you must be happy, that it's your natural right, that your first duty is to yourself, that will be the man who's not after your soul. That will be the man who has nothing to gain from you. But let him come, and you'll scream your empty heads off, howling that he's a selfish monster. So the racket is safe for many, many centuries. But here you might have noticed something. I said, it stands to reason. Do you see? Men have a weapon against you. Reason. So you must be very sure to take it away from them. Cut the props from under it. But be careful. Don't deny outright. Never deny anything outright. You give your hand away. Don't say reason is evil, though some have gone that far and with astonishing success. Just say that reason is limited. That there's something about it. What? You don't have to be too clear about it either. The field's inexhaustible. Instinct, feeling, revelation, divine intuition, dialectic materialism. If you get caught at some crucial point and somebody tells you that your doctrine doesn't make sense, you're ready for him. You tell him that there's something above sense. That here he must not try to think. He must feel. He must believe. Suspend reason, and you play it deuces wild. Anything goes in any manner you wish, whenever you need it. You've got him. Can you rule a thinking man? We don't want any thinking men. Keating had sat down on the floor by the side of the dresser. He had felt tired, and he had simply folded his legs. He did not want to abandon the dresser. He felt safer leaning against it, as if it still guarded the letter he had surrendered. Peter, you've heard all this. You've seen me practicing it for 10 years. You see it being practiced all over the world. Why are you disgusted? You have no right to sit there and stare at me with the virtuous superiority of being shocked. You're in on it. You've taken your share, and you've got to go along. You're afraid to see where it's leading. I'm not. I'll tell you. The world of the future. The world I want. A world of obedience and of unity. A world where the thought of each man will not be his own, but an attempt to guess the thought in the brain of his neighbor, who'll have no thought of his own, but an attempt to guess the thought of the next neighbor, who'll have no thought, and so on, Peter, around the globe. Since all must agree with all. A world where no man will hold a desire for himself, but will direct all his efforts to satisfy the desires of his neighbor, who'll have no desires except to satisfy the desires of the next neighbor, who'll have no desires. Around the globe, Peter. Since all must serve all. A world in which man will not work for so innocent an incentive as money, but for that headless monster, prestige, the approval of his fellows, their good opinion, the opinion of men who'll be allowed to hold no opinion, an octopus, all tentacles and no brain. Judgment, Peter? Not judgment, but public polls, an average drawn upon zeros, since no individuality will be permitted, a world with its motor cut off, and a single heart pumped by hand. My hand. And the hands of a few, a very few other men like me, those who know what makes you tick, you great, wonderful average. You who have not risen in fury when we called you the average, the little, the common. You who've liked and accepted those names. You'll sit enthroned and enshrined. You, the little people, the absolute ruler to make all past rulers squirm with envy, the absolute, the unlimited god and prophet and king combined. Vox populi. The average, the common, the general. Do you know the proper antonym for ego? Bromide, Peter. The rule of the bromide. But even the trite has to be originated by someone at some time. We'll do the originating. Vox Dei. We'll enjoy unlimited submission from men who've learned nothing except to submit. We'll call it to serve. We'll give out medals for service. You'll fall over one another in a scramble to see who can submit better and more. There will be no other distinction to seek, no other form of personal achievement. Can you see Howard Rourke in the picture? No? Then don't waste time on foolish questions. Everything that can't be ruled must go. And if freaks persist in being born occasionally, they will not survive beyond their 12th year. When their brain begins to function, it will feel the pressure, and it will explode. The pressure gauged to a vacuum. Do you know the fate of deep-sea creatures brought out to sunlight? So much for future Rourkes. The rest of you will smile and obey. Have you noticed that the imbecile always smiles? Man's first frown is the first touch of God on his forehead, the touch of thought. But we'll have neither God nor thought, only voting by smiles, automatic levers, all saying, yes. Now, if you were a little more intelligent, like your ex-wife, for instance, you'd ask, what of us, the rulers? What of me, Ellsworth Monckton Toohey? And I'd say, yes, you're right. I'll achieve no more than you will. I'll have no purpose save to keep you contented, to lie, to flatter you, to praise you, to inflate your vanity, to make speeches about the people and the common good. Peter, my poor old friend, I'm the most selfless man you've ever known. I have less independence than you, whom I just forced to sell your soul. You've used people at least for the sake of what you could get from them for yourself. I want nothing for myself. I use people for the sake of what I can do to them. It's my only function and satisfaction. I have no private purpose. I want power. I want my world of the future. Let all live for all. Let all sacrifice and none profit. Let all suffer and none enjoy. Let progress stop. Let all stagnate. There's a quality in stagnation, all subjugated to the will of all, universal slavery, without even the dignity of a master, slavery to slavery, a great circle, and a total equality, the world of the future. Ellsworth, you're insane, afraid to say it. There you sit, and the words written all over you, your last hope. Insane? Look around you. Pick up any newspaper and read the headlines. Isn't it coming? Isn't it here? Every single thing I told you is in Europe swallowed already, and we're stumbling on to follow. Everything I said is contained in a single word, collectivism. And isn't that the god of our century? To act together, to think, together, to feel, together. To unite, to agree, to obey, to serve, to sacrifice. Divide and conquer, first, but then, unite and rule. We've discovered that one at last. Remember the Roman emperor who said he wished humanity had a single neck so he could cut it? People have laughed at him for centuries, but we'll have the last laugh. We've accomplished what he couldn't accomplish. We've taught men to unite. This makes one neck ready for one leash. We found the magic word. Collectivism. Look at Europe, you fool. Can't you see past the guff and recognize the essence? One country is dedicated to the proposition that man has no rights, that the collective is all, the individual held as evil, the mass as God, no motive and no virtue permitted, except that of service to the proletariat. That's one version. Here's another. A country dedicated to the proposition that man has no rights, that the state is all, the individual held as evil, the race as God. No motive and no virtue permitted, except that of service to the race. Am I raving? Or is this the cold reality of two continents already? Watch the pincer movement. If you're sick of one version, we'll push you into the other. We get you coming and going. We've closed the doors. We've fixed the coin. Heads, collectivism, and tails, collectivism. Fight the doctrine which slaughters the individual with a doctrine which slaughters the individual. Give up your soul to a council, or give it up to a leader, but give it up. Give it up. Give it up. My technique, Peter. Offer poison as food, and poison as antidote. Go fancy on the trimmings, but hang on to the main objective. Give the fools a choice. Let them have their fun. But don't forget the only purpose you have to accomplish. Kill the individual. Kill man's soul. The rest will follow automatically. Observe the state of the world as of the present moment. Do you still think I'm crazy, Peter? Keating sat on the floor, his legs spread out. He lifted one hand and studied his fingertips, then put it to his mouth and bit off a hangnail. But the movement was deceptive. The man was reduced to a single sense, the sense of hearing, and Tui knew that no answer could be expected. Keating waited obediently. It seemed to make no difference. The sounds had stopped, and it was now his function to wait until they started again. Tui put his hands on the arms of his chair, then lifted his palms from the wrists, and clasped the wood again. A little slap of resigned finality. He pushed himself up to his feet. "Thank you, Peter," he said gravely. "Honesty is a hard thing to eradicate. I've made speeches to large audiences all my life. This was the speech I'll never have a chance to make." Keating lifted his head. His voice had the quality of a down payment on terror. It was not frightened, but it held the advance echoes of the next hour to come. "Don't go, Ellsworth." Tui stood over him and laughed softly. "That's the answer, Peter. That's my proof. You know me for what I am. You know what I've done to you. You have no illusions of virtue left. But you can't leave me. And you'll never be able to leave me. You've obeyed me in the name of ideals. You'll go on obeying me without ideals. Because that's all you're good for now. Good night, Peter." Chapter 15. This is a test case. What we think of it will determine what we are. In the person of Howard Rourke, we must crush the forces of selfishness and antisocial individualism, the curse of our modern world, here shown to us in ultimate consequences. As mentioned at the beginning of this column, the district attorney now has in his possession a piece of evidence, we cannot disclose its nature at this moment, which proves conclusively that Rourke is guilty. We, the people, shall now demand justice. This appeared in one small voice on a morning late in May. Gail Winand read it in his car driving home from the airport. He had flown to Chicago in a last attempt to hold a national advertiser who had refused to renew a $3 million contract. 2 days of skillful effort had failed. Winand lost the advertiser. Stepping off the plane in Newark, he picked up the New York papers. His car was waiting to take him to his country house. Then he read one small voice. He wondered for a moment what paper he held. He looked at the name on the top of the page. But it was the banner, and the column was there in its proper place. Column 1, first page, second section. He leaned forward and told the chauffeur to drive to his office. He sat with the page spread open on his lap until the car stopped before the banner building. He noticed it at once when he entered the building, in the eyes of two reporters who emerged from an elevator in the lobby. In the pose of the elevator man who fought a desire to turn and stare back at him, in the sudden immobility of all the men in his anteroom, in the break of a typewriter's clicking on the desk of one secretary, in the lifted hand of another, he saw the waiting. Then he knew that all the implications of the unbelievable were understood by everyone on his paper. He felt a first dim shock, because the waiting around him contained wonder, and something was wrong if there could be any wonder in anyone's mind about the outcome of an issue between him and Ellsworth Toohey. But he had no time to take notice of his own reactions. He had no attention to spare for anything except a sense of tightness, a pressure against the bones of his face, his teeth, his cheeks, the bridge of his nose. And he knew he must press back against that, keep it down, hold it. He greeted no one and walked into his office. Alva Skerritt sat slumped in a chair before his desk. Skerritt had a bandage of soiled white gauze on his throat, and his cheeks were flushed. Wynand stopped in the middle of the room. The people outside had felt relieved. Wynand's face looked calm. Alva Skerritt knew better.
"Gale, I wasn't here,"
he gulped in a cracked whisper that was not a voice at all.
"I haven't been here for 2 days. Laryngitis, Gale. Ask my doctor. I wasn't here. I just got out of bed. Look at me. I've got 103 fever. I mean, the doctor didn't want me to, but I... to get up, I mean. Gale, I wasn't here. I wasn't here."
He could not be certain that Wynand heard, but Wynand let him finish, then assumed the appearance of listening, as if the sounds were reaching him, delayed. After a moment, Wynand asked, "Who was on the copy desk?"
It went through Allen and Falk.
Fire Harding, Allen, Falk, and Toohey. Buy off Harding's contract, but not Toohey's. Have them all out of the building in 15 minutes. Harding was the managing editor, Falk, a copy reader, Allen, the slot man, head of the copy desk. All had worked on the banner for more than 10 years. It was as if Skerritt had heard a news flash announcing the impeachment of a president, the destruction of New York City by a meteor, and the sinking of California into the Pacific Ocean.
"Gale!"
he screamed.
"We can't!"
"Get out of here." Skerritt got out. Wynand pressed a switch on his desk and said in answer to the trembling voice of the woman outside, "Don't admit anyone."
"Yes, Mr. Wynand."
He pressed a button and spoke to the circulation manager. "Stop every copy on the street." "Mr. Wynand, it's too late. Most of them are..." "Stop them." "Yes, Mr. Wynand." He wanted to put his head down on the desk, lie still, and rest. Only the form of rest he needed did not exist, greater than sleep, greater than death, the rest of having never lived. The wish was like a secret taunt against himself, because he knew that the splitting pressure in his skull meant the opposite, an urge to action, so strong that he felt paralyzed. He fumbled for some sheets of clean paper, forgetting where he kept them. He had to write the editorial that would explain and counteract. He had to hurry. He felt no right to any minute that passed with the thing unwritten. The pressure disappeared with the first word he put on paper. He thought, while his hand moved rapidly, what a power there was in words. Later, for those who heard them, but first, for the one who found them, a healing power, a solution, like the breaking of a barrier. He thought, perhaps the basic secret the scientists have never discovered, the first fount of life, is that which happens when a thought takes shape in words. He heard the rumble, the vibration in the walls of his office, in the floor. The presses were running off his afternoon paper, a small tabloid, the Clarion. He smiled at the sound. His hand went faster, as if the sound were energy pumped into his fingers. He had dropped his usual editorial "we." He wrote, "And if my readers or my enemies wish to laugh at me over this incident, I shall accept it and consider it the payment of a debt incurred. I have deserved it." He thought, "It's the heart of this building, beating. What time is it? Do I really hear it, or is it my own heart? Once a doctor put the ends of his stethoscope to my ears and let me hear my own heartbeats. It sounded just like this. He said I was a healthy animal and good for many years. For many years. I have foisted upon my readers a contemptible blackguard whose spiritual stature is my only excuse. I had not reached a degree of contempt for society such as would have permitted me to consider him dangerous. I am still holding on to a respect for my fellow men, sufficient to let me say that Ellsworth Toohey cannot be a menace. They say sound never dies, but travels on in space. What happens to a man's heartbeats? So many of them in 56 years. Could they be gathered again in some sort of condenser and put to use once more? If they were rebroadcast, would the result be the beating of those presses? But I have sponsored him under the masthead of my paper, and if public penance is a strange, humiliating act to perform in our modern age, such is the punishment I impose upon myself hereby. Not 56 years of those soft little drops of sound a man never hears, each single and final, not like a comma, but like a period, a long string of periods on a page gathered to feed those presses. Not 56, but 31. The other 25 went to make me ready. I was 25 when I raised the new masthead over the door. Publishers don't change the name of a paper. This one does. The New York Banner. Gail Winans' Banner. I ask the forgiveness of every man who has ever read this paper. A healthy animal. And that which comes from me is healthy. I must bring that doctor here and have him listen to those presses. He'll grin in his good, smug, satisfied way. Doctors like a specimen of perfect health occasionally. It's rare enough. I must give him a treat. The healthiest sound he ever heard. And he'll say the Banner is good for many years. The door of his office opened, and Ellsworth Toohey came in. Winant let him cross the room and approach the desk, without a gesture of protest. Winant thought that what he felt was curiosity, if curiosity could be blown into the dimensions of a thing from the abyss, like those drawings of beetles the size of a house advancing upon human figures in the pages of the Banner's Sunday supplement. Curiosity, because Ellsworth Toohey was still in the building, because Toohey had gained admittance past the orders given, and because Toohey was laughing.
"I came to take my leave of absence, Mr. Winant," said Toohey.
His face was composed. It expressed no gloating. The face of an artist who knew that overdoing was defeat and achieved the supreme of offensiveness by remaining normal.
"And to tell you that I'll be back. On this job, on this column, in this building. In the interval, you will have seen the nature of the mistake you've made. Do forgive me, I know this is in utterly bad taste, but I've waited for it for 13 years, and I think I can permit myself 5 minutes as a reward." "So, you were a possessive man, Mr. Winant, and you loved your sense of property. Did you ever stop to think what it rested upon? Did you stop to secure the foundations? No, because you were a practical man. Practical men deal in bank accounts, real estate, advertising contracts, and gilt-edged securities. They leave to the impractical intellectuals like me the amusements of putting the gilt edges through a chemical analysis to learn a few things about the nature and the source of gold. They hang on to cream o' pudding, and leave us such trivia as the theater, the movies, the radio, the schools, the book reviews, and the criticism of architecture. Just a sop to keep us quiet if we care to waste our time playing with the inconsequentials of life while you're making money. Money is power. Is it, Mr. Winant? So you were after power, Mr. Winant? Power over men? You poor amateur. You never discovered the nature of your own ambition, or you'd have known that you weren't fit for it. You couldn't use the methods required, and you wouldn't want the results. You've never been enough of a scoundrel. I don't mind handing you that because I don't know which is worse, to be a great scoundrel or a gigantic fool. That's why I'll be back. And when I am, I'll run this paper."
Winant said quietly, "When you are. Now get out of here." The city room of the Banner walked out on strike. The union of Winant employees walked out in a body. A great many others, non-members, joined them. The typographical staff remained. Winant had never given a thought to the union. He paid higher wages than any other publisher, and no economic demands had ever been made upon him.
If his employees wished to amuse themselves by listening to speeches, he saw no reason to worry about it. Dominique had tried to warn him once. Cale, if people want to organize for wages, hours, or practical demands, it's their proper right. But when there's no tangible purpose, you'd better watch closely. Darling, how many times do I have to ask you? Keep off the banner. He had never taken the trouble to learn who belonged to the union. He found now that the membership was small and crucial. It included all his key men, not the big executives, but the rank below, expertly chosen, the active ones, the small, indispensable spark plugs, the best leg men, the general assignment men, the rewrite men, the assistant editors. He looked up their records. Most of them had been hired in the last 8 years, recommended by Mr. Toohey. Non-members walked out for various reasons, some because they hated Winand, others because they were afraid to remain, and it seemed easier than to analyze the issue. One man, a timid little fellow, met Winand in the hall and stopped to shriek, "We'll be back, sweetheart, and then it will be a different tune." Some left, avoiding the sight of Winand. Others played safe. "Mr. Winand, I hate to do it. I hate it like hell. I had nothing to do with that union, but a strike's a strike, and I can't permit myself to be a scab. Honest, Mr. Winand, I don't know who's right or wrong. I do think Ellsworth pulled a dirty trick, and Harding had no business letting him get away with it, but how can one be sure who's right about anything nowadays? And one thing I won't do is I won't cross a picket line, no sir. The way I feel is, picket's right or wrong." The strikers presented two demands. The reinstatement of the four men who had been discharged. A reversal of the banner's stand on the Cortland case. Harding, the managing editor, wrote an article explaining his position. It was published in the New Frontiers. "I did ignore Mr. Winand's orders in a matter of policy, perhaps an unprecedented action for a managing editor to take. I did so with full realization of the responsibility involved. Mr. Toohey, Allen, Falk, and I wished to save the banner for the sake of its employees, its stockholders, and its readers. We wished to bring Mr. Winand to reason by peaceful means. We hoped he would give in with good grace once he had seen the banner committed to the stand shared by most of the press of the country. We knew the arbitrary, unpredictable, and unscrupulous character of our employer, but we took the chance, willing to sacrifice ourselves to our professional duty. While we recognize an owner's right to dictate the policy of his paper on political, sociological, or economic issues, we believe that a situation has gone past the limits of decency when an employer expects self-respecting men to espouse the cause of a common criminal. We wish Mr. Winand to realize that the day of dictatorial one-man rule is past. We must have some say in the running of the place where we make our living. It is a fight for the freedom of the press." Mr. Harding was 60 years old, owned an estate on Long Island, and divided his spare time between skeet shooting and breeding pheasants. His childless wife was a member of the board of directors of the Workshop for Social Study. Toohey, its star lecturer, had introduced her to the workshop. She had written her husband's article. The two men off the copy desk were not members of Toohey's union. Allen's daughter was a beautiful young actress, starred in all of Ike's plays. Falk's brother was secretary to Lancelot Clokey. Cale Winand sat at the desk in his office and looked down at a pile of paper. He had many things to do. But one picture kept coming back to him, and he could not get rid of it, and the sense of it clung to all his actions. The picture of a ragged boy standing before the desk of an editor. Can you spell cat? Can you spell anthropomorphology? The identities cracked and became mixed. It seemed to him that the boy stood here at his desk, waiting, and once he said aloud, "Go away." He caught himself in anger. He thought, "You're cracking, you fool, now's not the time." He did not speak aloud again, but the conversation went on silently while he read, checked, and signed papers. "Go away. We have no jobs here. I'll hang around. Use me when you want to. You don't have to pay me." "They're paying you. Don't you understand, you little fool? They're paying you." Aloud, his voice normal, he said into a telephone, "Tell Manning that we'll have to fill in with Matt stuff. Send up the proofs as soon as you can. Send up a sandwich. Any kind." A few had remained with him. The old men and the copy boys. They came in the morning, often with cuts on their faces and blood on their collars. One stumbled in, his skull open, and had to be sent away in an ambulance. It was neither courage nor loyalty. It was inertia. They had lived too long with the thought that the world would end if they lost their jobs on the banner. The old ones did not understand. The young ones did not care. Copy boys were sent out on reporters' beats. Most of the stuff they sent in was of such quality that Wynant was forced, past despair, into howls of laughter. He had never read such highbrow English. He could see the pride of the ambitious youth who was a journalist at last. He did not laugh when the stories appeared in the Banner as written. There were not enough rewrite men. He tried to hire new men. He offered extravagant salaries. The people he wanted refused to work for him. A few men answered his call, and he wished they hadn't, though he hired them. They were men who had not been employed by a reputable newspaper for 10 years, the kind who would not have been allowed a month ago into the lobby of his building. Some of them had to be thrown out in 2 days. Others remained. They were drunk most of the time. Some acted as if they were granting Wynant a favor. "Don't you get huffy, Gale, old boy," said one, and was tossed bodily down 2 flights of stairs. He broke an ankle and sat on the bottom landing, looking up at Wynant with an air of complete astonishment. Others were subtler. They merely stalked about and looked at Wynant slyly, almost winking, implying that they were fellow criminals tied together in a dirty deal. He appealed to schools of journalism. No one responded. One student body sent him a resolution signed by all its members. "Entering our careers with a high regard for the dignity of our profession, dedicating ourselves to uphold the honor of the press, we feel that none among us could preserve his self-respect and accept an offer such as yours." The news editor had remained at his desk. The city editor had gone. Wynant filled in as city editor, managing editor, wire man, rewrite man, copy boy. He did not leave his building. He slept on a couch in his office, as he had done in the first years of the Banner's existence. Coatless, tieless, his shirt collar torn open, he ran up and down the stairs, his steps like the rattle of a machine gun. 2 elevator boys had remained, the others had vanished. No one knew just when or why, whether prompted by sympathy for the strike, fear, or plain discouragement. Alva Skerritt could not understand Wynan's calm. The brilliant machine, and that thought Skerritt was really the word which had always stood for Wynant in his mind, had never functioned better. His words were brief, his orders rapid, his decisions immediate. In the confusion of machines, lead, grease, ink, waste paper, unswept offices, untenanted desks, glass crashing in sudden showers when a brick was hurled from the street below, Wynant moved like a figure in double exposure, superimposed on his background, out of place and scale. "He doesn't belong here," thought Skerritt, "because he doesn't look modern. That's what it is. He doesn't look modern, no matter what kind of pants he's wearing. He looks like something out of a Gothic cathedral. The patrician head held level, the fleshless face that had shrunk tighter together, the captain of a ship known by all, save the captain, to be sinking." Alva Skerritt had remained. He had not grasped that the events were real. He shuffled about in a stupor. He felt a fresh jolt of bewilderment each morning when he drove up to the building and saw the pickets. He suffered no injury beyond a few tomatoes hurled at his windshield. He tried to help Wynant. He tried to do his work and that of 5 other men, but he could not complete a normal day's task. He was going quietly to pieces, his joints wrenched loose by a question mark. He wasted everybody's time, interrupting anything to ask, "But why? Why? How, just like that, all of a sudden?" He saw a nurse in white uniform walking down the hall. An emergency first aid station had been established on the ground floor. He saw her carrying a wastebasket to the incinerator with wadded clumps of gauze, bloodstained. He turned away. He felt sick. It was not the sight, but the greater terror of an implication grasped by his instinct. This civilized building, secure in the neatness of waxed floors, respectable with the strict grooming of modern business, a place where one dealt in such rational matters as written words and trade contracts, where one accepted ads for baby garments and chatted about golf, had become in the span of a few days a place where one carried bloody refuse through the halls. "Why?" thought Alva Skerritt. I can't understand it, he droned in an accentless monotone to anyone around him. I can't understand how Ellsworth got so much power, and Ellsworth's a man of culture, an idealist, not a dirty radical off a soapbox. He's so friendly and witty, and what an erudition! A man who jokes all the time is not a man of violence. Ellsworth didn't mean this. He didn't know what it would lead to. He loves people. I'd stake my shirt on Ellsworth, Tui. Once in Winan's office, he ventured to say, Gale, why don't you negotiate? Why don't you meet with them at least? Shut up. But Gale, there might be a bit of truth on their side, too. They're newspapermen. You know what they say, the freedom of the press. Then he saw the fit of fury he had expected for days, and had thought safely sidetracked. The blue irises vanishing in a white smear, the blind, luminous eyeballs in a face that was all cavities, the trembling hands. But in a moment, he saw what he had never witnessed before. He saw Winand break the fit, without sound, without relief. He saw the sweat of the effort on the hollow temples, and the fists on the edge of the desk. Alva, if I had not sat on the stairs of the Gazette for a week, where would be the press for them to be free on? There were policemen outside, and in the halls of the building. It helped, but not much. One night, acid was thrown at the main entrance. It burned the big plate glass of the ground floor windows and left leprous spots on the walls. Sand in the bearings stopped one of the presses. An obscure delicatessen owner got his shop smashed for advertising in the Banner. A great many small advertisers withdrew. Winand delivery trucks were wrecked. One driver was killed. The striking union of Winand employees issued a protest against acts of violence. The union had not instigated them. Most of its members did not know who had. The New Frontiers said something about regrettable excesses, but ascribed them to spontaneous outbursts of justifiable popular anger. Homer Slattern, in the name of a group who called themselves the Liberal Businessmen, sent Winand a notice canceling their advertising contracts. You may sue us if you wish. We feel we have a legitimate cause for cancellation. We signed to advertise in a reputable newspaper, not in a sheet that has become a public disgrace, brings pickets to our doors, ruins our business, and is not being read by anybody. The group included most of the Banner's wealthiest advertisers. Gale Winand stood at the window of his office and looked at his city. I have supported strikes at a time when it was dangerous to do so. I have fought Gale Winand all my life. I had never expected to see the day, or the issue, when I would be forced to say, as I say now, that I stand on the side of Gale Winand, wrote Austin Heller in the Chronicle. Winand sent him a note. God damn you, I didn't ask you to defend me. G.W. The New Frontiers described Austin Heller as a reactionary who has sold himself to big business. Intellectual Society ladies said that Austin Heller was old-fashioned. Gale Winand stood at a desk in the City Room and wrote editorials as usual. His derelict staff saw no change in him, no haste, no outbursts of anger. There was nobody to notice that some of his actions were new. He would go to the press room and stand looking at the white stream shot out of the roaring giants and listen to the sound. He would pick up a lead slug off the composing room floor and finger it absently on the palm of his hand like a piece of jade and lay it carefully on a table as if he did not want it to be wasted. He fought other forms of such waste, not noticing it, the gestures instinctive. He retrieved pencils. He spent a half hour, while telephones shrieked unanswered, repairing a typewriter that had broken down. It was not a matter of economy. He signed checks without looking at the figures. Skerritt was afraid to think of the amounts each passing day cost him. It was a matter of things that were part of the building where he loved every doorknob, things that belonged to the Banner, that belonged to him. Late each afternoon, he telephoned Dominique in the country. Fine. Everything under control. Don't listen to panic mongers. No, to hell with it. You know I don't want to talk about the damn paper. Tell me what the garden looks like. Did you go swimming today? Tell me about the lake. What dress are you wearing? Listen to WLX tonight at 8. They'll have your pet. Rachmaninoff, Second Concerto. Of course I have time to keep informed about everything. Oh, all right, I see one can't fool an ex-newspaper woman. I did go over the radio page. Of course we have plenty of help. It's just that I can't quite trust some of the new boys, and I had a moment to spare. Above all, don't come to town. You promise me that. Good night, dearest. He hung up and sat looking at the telephone, smiling. The thought of the countryside was like the thought of a continent beyond an ocean that could not be crossed. It gave him a sense of being locked in a besieged fortress, and he liked that. Not the fact, but the feeling. His face looked like a throwback to some distant ancestor who had fought on the ramparts of a castle. One evening he went out to the restaurant across the street. He had not eaten a complete meal for days. The streets were still light when he came back, the placid brown haze of summer, as if dulled sun rays remained stretched too comfortably on the warm air to undertake a movement of withdrawal, even though the sun had long since gone. It made the sky look fresh, and the street dirty. There were patches of brown and tired orange in the corners of old buildings. He saw pickets pacing in front of the banner's entrance. There were eight of them, and they marched around and around in a long oval on the sidewalk. He recognized one boy, a police reporter. He had never seen any of the others. They carried signs. Tui Harding Allen Falk. The Freedom of the Press. Gail Winand Tramples Human Rights. His eyes kept following one woman. Her hips began at her ankles, bulging over the tight straps of her shoes. She had square shoulders and a long coat of cheap brown tweed over a huge square body. She had small white hands, the kind that would drop things all over the kitchen. She had an incision of a mouth without lips, and she waddled as she moved, but she moved with surprising briskness. Her steps defied the whole world to hurt her, with a malicious slyness that seemed to say she would like nothing better, because what a joke it would be on the world if it tried to hurt her. Just try it and see, just try it. Winand knew she had never been employed on the banner. She never could be. It did not appear likely that she could be taught to read. Her steps seemed to add that she jolly well didn't have to. She carried a sign. We demand... He thought of the nights when he had slept on the couch in the old banner building in the first years, because the new presses had to be paid for, and the banner had to be on the streets before its competitors. And he coughed blood one night and refused to see a doctor. But it turned out to be nothing. Just exhaustion. He hurried into the building. The presses were rolling. He stood and listened for a while. At night the building was quiet. It seemed bigger, as if sound took space and vacated it. There were panels of light at open doors, between long stretches of dim hallways. A lone typewriter clicked somewhere, evenly, like a dripping faucet. Winand walked through the halls. He thought that men had been willing to work for him when he plugged known crooks for municipal elections, when he glamorized red light districts, when he ruined reputations by scandalous libel, when he sobbed over the mothers of gangsters. Talented men, respected men, had been eager to work for him. Now he was being honest for the first time in his career. He was leading his greatest crusade. With the help of finks, drifters, drunkards, and humble drudges too passive to quit. The guilt, he thought, was not perhaps with those who now refused to work for him.